Accession number 27185, Reel 52.
Major Barras, Reel 52. You were saying back to British Honduras.
Yeah. Well, I pretty well finished there. But I remember the local political party there was the PUP, which was the People's United Party, which was headed up by a guy called Price. I remember he was a local. And he couldn't wait to become president of British Honduras. On the other hand, he knew perfectly well that he couldn't do without us, otherwise the Guatemalans would be in. So there was never any problem with the local people. But he was a bit ambitious. But he never made much headway. He was more talk than anything else.
Do you remember what measures you could recommend to improve security at the airport against the...
Yes, well, when I got back, I wrote up, obviously, a report about the whole thing, pointing out that it was impossible to get across. A proper force couldn't get across the border by land. You could rule out Ponta Gorda, except for sort of their own political demonstration. And that we needed to have a permanent force on the airport, which should be a company group, I recommended, with mortars. Probably if they got an anti-tank or weapon or two to shoot at aircraft if they came in. Mm. And supporting services, medics, REMI, ordnance, that sort of thing, because you always need that when you're on detachment miles away from anywhere.
Well, a company group acting independently has to have everything, doesn't it?
It does, yes. Mm. So this was accepted, and very shortly after that we moved, well, the Royal Welsh moved a company group over there, and there's been a British Army element there almost ever since. I don't know whether they're still there. Still there.
Still a garrison, as far as I know.
Yeah, these, yeah. Well, that's when it started. Mm. And
how long did it take to get that organised for the...
Not long.
...formation of the company group and its movement?
Oh, not long, not long. It does, those sort of things don't take very long. Mm. You have to start thinking about married families, what they're going to happen to them when go. But, I mean, the group, would, the company that went over had a sort of a limited time there. Mm. And would be changed over, and I can't remember how long it was, changed over, and another lot would come over.
Were there any facilities there for accommodation?
No, we had to have tents, first of all. I think more permanent accommodation was built later, but initially we had to have tents, and anything else which we needed had to be brought ourselves.
How long was the tour of duty for the company group?
I can't remember. It probably varied, I would think. I don't suppose it was... I mean, when they went, somebody would say, the CO or the brigadier would say, right. Or he would leave it to the CO of battalion, I should think, to decide. I mean, the brigadier would say to the CO, OK, well, we want a garrison there. It's up to you to produce, position this garrison. We will write out the operation orders for it, which I had to do, as to standing orders and everything else as to why they were there and what they would do in emergencies and so forth. And probably say that they would be relieved from time to time in accordance with the requirements of the regiment.
How are they actually delivered there and recovered? Was this by air or by sea at that time?
God, you know, I can't remember.
What about sustaining them, the logistics support? How did they get that?
Well, a lot of stuff was I think we got round to buying stuff, local stuff. Mm. I would imagine that most of it was done by sea. Mm. Must have been.
Were they to be in...
They must have gone by sea. I don't imagine that. Although we did, later on we moved a company by air, as you will see. Yeah. But it took three aeroplanes. But then most of all the other stuff had to come by sea. All the heavy stuff has to go by sea.
Were they to construct fighting positions when they got to the airport? Was that the idea that they would put up sangars or sandbags or dig in around the perimeter or anything like that?
Yes, yes, they had. Oh, yes, they had emergency positions to go to. And they had alarms and all kinds of things. And they had to get on with their training as well. But it was all new then. It had to be all worked out and thought out, and as time went by, then extra measures were brought in. And
well, did your plan encompass a role for the local volunteers as well as for the regular company?
No, I don't think so. Mm. Not in an offensive way. I think they might have been there to help as liaison between the British military and the local civilians, because they were very useful in that way. But I don't think we gave them a task, actually. I can't remember. It may have done. I've got to remember this is 50 years ago.
Presumably, though, I mean, they might have been useful to just watch that unmade road you just described.
Yes, I think we may well have done something like that, put them out as... but then, of course, you don't... It was all a question, really, of finding out what was going on inside Guatemala. There was you don't have people standing to at 24 hours notice if the Guatemalan army is all fast asleep in its barracks. And this information we got through our SLO as to what was happening. If there was any sign of activity in the army that they're beginning to muster or mobilize, then was the time, obviously, when... states of readiness had to be brought in. And of course there was a backup if there had been a big blow up there. The plan was for the rest of the regiment to go there if needed.
What sort of strength was the Guatemalan army at that time? Did you have any idea of their numbers?
We probably did. I mean, had it come to the point, they might have... I mean, there was no doubt that anybody with a gun can kill people. Mm. Doesn't matter how well trained they are, as we found out in the Falklands. Some of the more untrained people, as long as you can sit in a position with a machine gun and fire, you can kill people. I don't know. I don't think we had a very high opinion of their military capability. But at the same time, the local force, local volunteers in British Honduras weren't strong enough or well equipped enough to be able to deal with them. That's why.
Relative strength, really, isn't it?
Yes.
Anything else. Was there any sort of political or other reaction to this deployment into?
What,
from the Guatemalans?
There probably was. I can't remember, but I expect there was sort of. A lot of propaganda put out by, because they were very vociferous most of the time anyway. So I think this probably made it even worse for a bit.
A louder noise,
yes, until they got used to it. And then they got sore throats and had to take a Strepsil and sit down for a bit, I expect. But I don't know, you can keep these things up for some time and then you suddenly find you've got domestic problems. It was domestic problems, which, in retrospect, which drove the Guatemalan president and his government to harp on the Honduras situation, British Honduras situation, diverted people's attention from the bad living conditions in their own country. I mean, that's quite common in certainly South Central America and other poor countries. They always say that they're being threatened, or that they are being deprived.
What were conditions like in British Honduras, as far as you could observe them?
They were not bad, actually. As far as I remember, there were a lot of... it was rather like going to Venice. There were a lot of canals and rivers there. But I didn't spend an awful lot of time going round the town, actually. I mean, from Government House to the airport... out to the boundary with Guatemala and back again, and time visiting the local volunteers. I didn't go round that. I must have passed through it. I mean, it was a typical sort of colonial town in those days. I mean, it was little shops and not much traffic around. Dogs, stray dogs, people walking about. Didn't seem to me they were worried about anything. They were quite calm, and no one was shouting for independence or anything, except Price, who sat in his office and shouted for it, but nobody took much notice of him. No, I can't remember too much about it. It was just quiet. What one would expect, I think, people were just going around their local business. Wasn't a rich country. I don't know what they depended on then, or why we ever decided to take it in the first place. Must have had something to do with the ships and fleet.
Well, one time I think we'd had a portion of the coast of Nicaragua, the Mosquito Coast.
Yes, yes.
British possession, which we'd given up.
That's right. Yes, we did.
We had obviously had an interest in maintaining some presence in Central America, whether for strategic or commercial reasons.
Yeah. There wasn't much commerce there, as far as I could make out. I don't know, but they probably grew sugar. I mean, everybody grew sugar out there. I don't know how they earned their money. Anyway, La Force was put there. I don't think it took too long to get it together and sent there, because there was always not exactly an inline picket, but each regiment, the Jamaica Battalion, which couldn't operate outside Jamaica for political reasons, obviously. You couldn't have Jamaicans going down to Grenada, for instance, and restoring order, because that would have been that would have made the situation worse. So the Royal Welsh Fusiliers were responsible for going out to anything which happened. So they always had a company on some state of readiness to go. Not sort of 24 hours or anything like that. But they've got their orders all written out and ready to know exactly what to do if they were told to go somewhere overseas. So one company would have been detailed for that particular job.
That warning.
Yeah, yeah, but not pretty long warning, not short warning.
How was the decision made? You came back from British Honduras with your ideas and wrote your recommendations. Mm. What happened then? Did you submit that directly to the brigadier?
Yeah,
and he.
I gave it to the brigadier, and then it was up to him to order Royal Welsh Fusiliers to do what they did. But he told me to obviously. Write out the operational order.
You wrote the operational
order? I wrote out all the orders, yes.
Had he made any changes to your proposals?
I don't think he did. I can't remember. He may have made some detailed ones and said, look, we've forgotten the goat or something. Or but by and large, the company group was considered to be right. obviously, the CEO of the Welsh would have, Royal Welsh, would have decided to make some small amendments for his own personal benefit of the men over there.
Would it be his decision which company to send?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. What he sent, as long as it was up to the strength that we required and able to do the job we required, then it was up to him. So, as I say, I think it's still there. Certainly after after they got their independence, there was a request for us to stay there, wasn't there?
Mm. I don't know. So.
And it's there have been more alarms since then, haven't there? I mean, the Royal Navy have been involved, the Air Force have been involved.
There's always, well, there are usually, as far as I know, about a battalion there.
Yes.
Because it's useful for jungle training.
Well, that's right. I think they found it useful for jungle training.
And a certain number of aircraft.
Yeah.
And I think that the Navy calls and conducts coastal patrols.
Yeah. Occasionally. Well, they've had a ship there quite a lot of the time, I believe. Well, not recently, but there was a period they went through when it was quite a strong.
Yes.
But as you say, I think they just took I don't think a battalion was necessary there personally, but unless there'd been a change in the situation. And the Guatemalans made a motorway up to the up to the border, which I doubt. I don't know why the aircraft were there. Perhaps they were needed to reconnaissance. They weren't reconnaissance. They were jump jets, weren't they?
They were Harriers. Yes.
Harriers.
The idea
yeah.
was that the airspace is best defended by aircraft.
Well, that's true.
Which is
well, maybe the Guatemalans had acquired some airplanes.
Mm.
Could be. Don't think we were worried about any of their an air force at that time. It never came up, so I don't think they had.
Well, I have a notion they got some aircraft from the Americans at one stage.
Oh, yeah. Because the Americans did a lot of giving people arms and things, and then it all came back in the end, didn't it? Unfortunately,
yes.
It came back to roost.
Well, yes, I think that they were giving various governments aircraft to help them strengthen them against the menace from Cuba.
Yes. Yes.
Or from indigenous left-wing
insurrections. That's right. Yeah.
And, of course, they could be used for other things as well,
that's
like threatening
right.
their neighbours.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, I got down here that shortly after that I went to a meeting in Panama with the Americans, I was accompanied again by my naval mate. And I remember we went there and we were put up in bachelor quarters again, and they entertained us right royally. I don't think we did much work. I think it's all a question of liaisons, of visits and keeping in touch. We have meeting, I mean, sort of, you know, bring us up to date with things. Well, they took us out shark fishing in the Pacific, and you the idea was, and they filled the boat up with crates of beer, you see, and then you take it in turns to sit in this swivel chair, armchair at the back of the ship boat, which was a beautiful speed launch, with the fishing rod sticking, big stout fishing rod sticking out behind, with something on the end which would attract the shark. And you took it in turns to sit in the chair. And if you got a strike, everybody would say, brilliant, you know, and pat you on the back. But that's the end of it, because you got out and the professional fish seaman then got in and brought the shark in. But it was an occasion for opening up cans of beer. It was a remarkable thing. I think I got a strike and I was congratulated. You know, it was the greatest thing that had happened since sliced bread. But I hadn't done anything. All I'd done was sit there with the rod. We caught one or two shark, I remember, and drank a considerable amount of beer.
Do you remember if the Americans had any sort of view of what you were doing in British Honduras? You know, because that would have been a significant.
Oh, I think I think that would have come up in the meetings. Yes, I think. In fact, they would have been warned. I'm sure we would have been warned them. You see, the headquarters in Panama was the headquarters for the Caribbean, so to speak, Panama and the Caribbean. Not all the Caribbean, but certainly included us. And it would have included the Central America bit, because being in the Panama. We would have informed them of our intentions. I think they would have considered unfriendly if we suddenly started
yes.
landing troops on the American mainland.
Of course.
So what's going on, you know, they're trying to invade our states. Mm. But no, we would have informed them.
Do you remember what their reaction was?
No, I don't think they would have. They would have just accepted it.
What was going on in Panama at that time? Because Panama is a peculiar sort of hybrid.
Yeah, so there wasn't any political trouble going on at that stage. I remember we were taken down to the Panama Canal and watched it in operation. That was quite an experience, going along the side there with all the levels that ships had to go, because it goes over a hump.
Yes, many locks, aren't
That's
there?
That's right, yes.
But were these facilities guarded and secured?
I cannot remember. They must have been, I think. Police must have been. I mean, they probably gave it to the local police, I would think, at that stage. I don't think at that. We're talking of the 50s now. I don't think there was. I mean, the Panamanians may have felt, or some of them may have thought they would like to get rid of the Americans. But, of course, that didn't happen for some time. And I think they realized that they weren't going to get rid of them for the time being anyway. And settled with them, because there certainly wasn't any, as far as I know. We never heard of any through anything through the grapevine or through ISLO that there was any likelihood of disturbances or riots in there. And I remember after the meeting coming back, I came back on my own. I couldn't get a direct flight. I had to go through Barranquilla and change planes there. And of course, it was a very rudimentary airport in those days. And all the announcements were in Spanish. So there I was, listening to all these Spanish announcements of flights just about to leave, because there were quite a number of flights through there. And so I queued up for every flight, which occurred to me afterwards a bit risky, because I could have found myself in tropical kitten Alaska or somewhere.
You could have flown out somewhere quite bizarre, couldn't
yes.
you?
I was rather careful. I mean, I watched the situation very carefully as to who was going on and what was going on. But I couldn't find anybody who could speak any English there, and all the announcements in Spanish. Anyway, I managed to get on the right plane and got back home all right in the end. Well, I suppose the next thing really was in April. On the 15th of April, I got married. I previously met my future wife soon after I got there in the previous year. She was introduced to me by somebody in the railway, a few years. And eventually we decided to get married. And on the 15th of April, we got married in the garrison church.
Was this a wedding with the full military honours?
Yes. Well, very kindly. I didn't ask for them. They provided them. We were married by the Bishop of Jamaica. When they heard that my father was a parson, they said, oh, you've got to have the bishop. So we had Basil Jamaica, who married us, supported by the chaplain.
Turning out the senior member of the family firm.
Yes. And because my father-in-law was quite a high figure in the local hierarchy, he was the local DCNO, Dominion Colonial and Overseas Barclays Bank. And he was the senior manager there. Well, he controlled the whole of the Barclays organization out there, and lived in splendid big bank house and cars and chauffeurs and God knows what they give them out there in those days. Anyway, so he gave away his daughter at the wedding, but because of that he had to invite a whole host of people from the governor downwards, and I had to invite people from the garrison. It was very difficult because it wasn't as if I was in a regiment and therefore had my mates.
You were on a staff.
I was on staff, and therefore I had to invite almost everybody of my rank.
Yes.
So we had all the lieutenant colonel, all the majors, and a number of captains who were staff captains at the headquarters, and the royal came to about 300.
That's a very large party. Indeed.
Yes, I can remember my father-in-law sort of putting his hand to his forehead, you know, saying, "We're going to be bankrupt." Had we got married at home, we'd have probably had half a dozen people there.
Were your parents able to get out?
No, they weren't, unfortunately. My parents haven't been outside the UK. In those days before the war, very few people went abroad, of course. The other thing, of course, was that we benefited greatly from presents. Because they were very generous, the people in Jamaica. And the plot out there was that you went to the big store. There were a number of very big stores there, departmental stores. And you said what you wanted. And you gave a list to the people in the store. And then the people who wanted to buy you something came in to find out what we wanted. They said they wanted a Wedgwood dinner set, which we did, actually. We put down a Wedgwood dinner set. Well, then it was up to somebody to say, all right, we'll contribute half a dozen dinner plates. And somebody else would say, all right, well, we're two vegetable dishes or something. And in the end, I mean, what we got was enormous. I mean, had we been at home, I'd have got hardly anything. Probably a silver toast rack or something. But they were exceedingly generous, and we had all these lovely presents.
Did you also get a married quarter?
Yes, we got a hiring. There weren't any sort of married... Well, there weren't any married quarters. There were married quarters in the camp, but there weren't any available. There were just a few for the headquarters staff, and, of course, the families of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers who were stationed there. But apparently there were none available, so we had to go house hunting. And we found a little house, it was a bungalow, but quite enough for us anyway. Up and behind Kingston Stony Hill, it was called. Higher up between us, where all the rich people lived. So the higher you went in the up Stony Hill, the richer you were. And there was big houses up there with swimming pools. And it was a nice place to be because you could look out right over Kingston. And it was just a little bit cooler there because you're a little bit higher up. And right out over the Caribbean. And we had a little garden there, which we grew corn in, I think. That was the main thing we grew. And lived there happily until we left, more or less. We had a honeymoon, though. We went to Bermuda for a week. We flew to Bermuda, had a week there. And then I think it was, I don't know where it was, my father-in-law who knew Ian Fleming, the...
The author.
The author. Mm. And he very kindly let us have his house on the north coast free of charge for 2 weeks, complete with staff. So Golden Eye it was called, just outside Oricabessa. And Noel Card was our neighbour.
The master.
The master, yes. So we had 3 weeks altogether, finishing up with our 2 weeks, and this lovely's got his own private beach. And it was lovely.
Did it make a significant difference to your military life or social life, having got married?
Well, I left the club, where I'd been on my own, more or less. I suppose it did make a bit of difference, yes.
And were you expected to do more official or semi-official?
Well, we did, yes. I mean, the first thing we did after we'd established ourselves there was to have a cocktail party as a sort of thank you to everybody, from the bishop and brigadier and everybody else downwards. I remember it went with an absolute wow, and I can remember the bishop walking about with a fixed grin on his face as he went off. I mean, it was a cocktail party. And everybody, this conversation was horrific. I mean, the decibels were sort of perceived, were enormous, I should say. And after they'd all gone, I said, that was a great success, wasn't it? And Anne was my wife. I said, that was brilliant for our first party. And then I looked at the drinks which I'd mixed, and I got them wrong. I got the too much... I'd given them dry martinis, and I'd given them the measure of gin which should have been martini. and the other way round.
Proportions reversed.
Yes, and they were in terrific form when they left.
No wonder.
I got congratulations long afterwards. Say, what a lovely party it was. Mm. So I never did it again, but I mean, I knew from then onwards that was the way to...
The magic formula.
Yes. So we settled ourselves in. I remember before we went to Goldeneye, before we were married, actually, and it was arranged we should go there, we were asked by Ian Fleming to go and see him so that he could have a look at us and make sure we were going to be good tenants, I suppose. So we visited him, and his girlfriend at that time was Lady Rothermere, the press baron's wife. And she was busy painting and he was busy writing when we went there. I like to think he was writing a James Bond novel when we went in. I don't know whether he was. Anyway, he was very kind, and we had a few drinks and left. So I have met the great man. I wrote him a letter, and he wrote me a nice letter back, which I got here. I'll show it to you afterwards. Then I got back to work. Shortly after that, I had to go off on another visit. To go to